Today's reading is from Job. Now when Job's three friends heard of all these troubles that had come upon him, each of them set out from his home. Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shunhite, and Zophar the Naamathite. They met together to go and console and comfort him. When they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him, and they raised their voices and wept aloud. They tore their robes and threw dust in the air upon their heads. They sat with him on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw his suffering was very great. The word of God for the people of God.
Thanks be to God.
Very good job reading, especially with some tongue twister words in there today. Well, I invite you to take out your outline you'll find in your bulletin, and hope this is helpful to you for taking notes. Maybe thoughts get stirred that I call God's stirrings, and it's easy, if you're like me at all, to get a few minutes apart and then forget, what was that thought? What was that idea? And I hope this is helpful for you in that regard. As much as anything I say, that you'll experience God speaking to you through the message, and this will help you to capture that. A man went to see the doctor and Florence, Italy, 1835. He was complaining about tremendous anxiety attacks, inability to sleep at night, so the doctor examined him fully and determined he was in prime physical condition. The physician said, "I think the problem is you're just sad, you're down, and I've got just the remedy. I want you to go to the circus. And I want you to pay particular attention to the featured individual in the circus, a man named Grimaldi, a clown. Every night he has people just rolling in the aisles laughing. I believe if you'll go to the circus and see Grimaldi, that's going to cure your sadness." The man just put his head down and shook and said, no, he'll do no good for me. I am Grimaldi. You know, at some time or another, we are all Grimaldi. We all take our turns with sadness at some time or another. But for some, the sadness is much, much deeper, and the trough is much, much longer. And the popular advice is, well, send in the clowns. But when we take our turn, and we have some kind of experience of our own of that kind of sadness, we know how shallow that advice can be. Bill Henson, who is now deceased, for many years of his career was the senior pastor, First United Methodist Church, Houston, Texas. Toward the end of his career, he got up to preach a sermon on depression. And he began the sermon by saying, "I owe you an apology." Some of you will remember, decades ago, I preached on depression here. And I need to apologize to you for that sermon, because for the last 2 years, I've gone through a tremendous depression. And I know now that I did not know what I was talking about. Elie Wiesel, the Holocaust survivor and accomplished author, experienced a car accident at one time in his life. It really shattered the left side of his body. He had to go through 10 hours of reconstructive surgery and then months and months of painful therapy. And friends kept trying to reassure him with this idea that it could have been worse. I mean, you could have been paralyzed. You could have been killed. It could have been worse. And he said that the advice of the friends reminded him of an old story, a Jewish story about a man who lost everything. He lost his job, he lost his house, he lost his money, lost his fiance, and friends would say, "Well, it could be worse with each episode. It could be worse." And finally, one day, he said, "How on earth could it be worse?" And the friend said, "It could have happened to me." Well, for some, that is the shadow behind the advice. It could have happened to me. I really don't know how to help you. And yet people who go through tremendous sadness, who go through depression, will say that key reasons they got through were people who knew how to help. So as we finish the series on depression today, we've been talking about it for 3 weeks now, and I've been hearing a lot of comments from many, many people about how it's touched on your life or your family's life. And it seems appropriate that we would end today thinking about how do we serve as a good friend or a good family member to someone who's going through depression. And I want to look at a story about a man who resembles the person in Elie Wiesel's story, a guy named Job who lost everything. He lost his health, he lost his fortune, and he got in such a despairing state following the death of his family members that he just said, God, I have no reason to live. If this is what the rest of life looks like, I can't do this. So one day he was visited by three friends. Three friends who give very unhelpful advice. And yet that story has been preserved through thousands of years, probably because in every generation we recognize the advice. Maybe the way it's offered changes a little bit. Maybe the exact way it's stated is somewhat different, but if we've ever been close to a position of a Job, the words are familiar. And maybe we've preserved the story because we learn how to be a good friend by understanding what not to do. So I want to look at what is unhelpful about their advice, and then I want to turn it on its head and say, what does this teach us about ways to be helpful? And then close with a final word to a particular group in our community and to all of us. So let's look at what's unhelpful about the advice of Job's friends. First of all, their advice to Job was to do something. To do something. Now we need to understand their framework in approaching suffering. They believed that all suffering is a result of God's punishment. Somebody's done something wrong, that's why you're hurting right now. So their advice to Job is confess your sin. And Job stands his ground and says, I've not committed a sin. I'm a righteous man. And they said, well, maybe you just don't remember what you did, so go ahead and confess anyway. And then they finally give up and say, well, maybe it's not something you did, but someone in your family, you need to confess for them. Somebody had to do something. Strip away the theological language in that. And we understand that their way of trying to help their friend is to say, if you would just do something, that will lift your spirit. Now, does that ring familiar at all? With interviews I've conducted with people in our church who've gone through depression, they talked about some of the unhelpful advice they received. These were among the top. Look on the bright side. Just think about all the good things you have. Another. Just make yourself go to some parties or go to church. People would say to me that the idea when you're in depression of engaging in social activity just seems impossible. And then another, well, then just do it for so-and-so. Now, the intention might be good. I'm trying to get you to do something that I know is going to help you. But if you don't have the ability to do it for yourself, well, then just do it for so-and-so. In other words, add a little guilt in there as if that's going to help somebody's condition. I mean, perhaps we've all heard advice where the idea, well, if you just go do something. Now, another unhelpful part of the advice, they made Job's problem a faith crisis. They made his problem a faith crisis. Obviously, it's because he has come into disfavor with God, and therefore he needs to confess or do something to get back in favor. You see, if it becomes simply a spiritual issue, you have no need to relate to a person in their suffering, right? Their suffering is nothing more than a problem that needs to be fixed. Does that sound familiar? Have you ever known any people who, when you're hurting, they try to fix you? I've heard folks say that when they've been in a time of depression, that some of the spiritual advice that was really unhelpful was the advice, just turn it over to God. People would say, just turn your depression over to God and you'll find the help that you need. One person said to me, that advice was like spiritual assault because it somehow felt like I'm not being faithful enough to merit God's help to get me out of this place of darkness. And then last of all, and probably the most unhelpful thing about these friends, they could not relate to Job's pain. They did not know his experience. They had not been where he was. They didn't know his physical torment. They didn't know the emotional pain of losing all of the family. And yet, they came to offer advice without trying to understand that. But now, for everything they did wrong, they actually did something right. And what they did right holds some clues about how we might be a good friend. We learn what they did right when they first arrived on the scene. When they first came to Job, they were so horrified over Job's condition. Well, listen to the words that come at the end of the reading we heard. They sat with him on the ground 7 days and 7 nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. In other words, they were their most helpful when they kept their mouth shut. There's something about their presence that was helpful. What does that look like for us? What does it look like to be present with somebody when they're in a time of pain? And this is where today's message can extend far beyond the topic of depression. It can be how any of us can be a helpful presence to a person when they're going through any time of suffering. So if we turn these arguments on their head, one of the things that we understand about how we can be present with people in a time of pain is to meet people where they are, not where we are comfortable. Meet people where they are, but it's so easy to give advice to people based on what works for us. Well, if you would just get outside, I always feel better when I get outdoors and get some sunshine. Well, just get up in the morning and get yourself going. That always helps me. Versus taking a moment to try to even understand what somebody's going through. One time I locked my keys in my car. I was in a large parking lot that was a tourist destination. There was a big bus next to my car. So there was a parade of people walking by me to get back on their bus, and they were looking at me trying to break into my car. And this one fellow walks up to me and he said, "Let me tell you what I do so that I don't ever have that problem. I have a little magnetic box I keep a spare key in, and I put it up under my car so I never get locked out of my car. I hope that helps you." And he got on the bus. I had one of two responses. You tell me which one you think I offered. One was, "Thank you so much for taking time out of your day to come and offer advice to me that might help me get out of some predicament in the future." Or number two, "You better get on that bus right now before you wish you were locked in my car with the keys." Which one do you think it was? So imagine if you're in a place of deep darkness and you don't feel the ability to do the simplest of things. And somebody said, "Well, if you just do this." It's like somebody said to me one time, it's not knowing what to do that's the problem. It's finding the ability to do it. And maybe the most helpful thing we can do is to show that we're willing to try to understand what somebody's going through. Nobody wants to be in a dark place. Who wants to relate to somebody who's in a dark place? This is not easy stuff. But when we at least try, that tells somebody we care enough to want to understand. One counselor said to me that sometimes the most simple of sentences can be the most helpful. To say to a person, "Just help me understand. Help me understand." You see, that does not presume to say, I do understand. And even if a person doesn't respond, it at least lets that person know that we care enough to relate to them where they are. After all, isn't that what we believe as Christians, that God cares about you and me enough? Not to just send us good information, but to actually come and relate to our experience. Maybe the most helpful thing we can do to people is to practice what we believe, to meet them where they are. Something else we see about ways to be present is to focus on the other person's need, not ours. To focus on their need, not ours. If you're caring for a person going through depression, you probably have to be willing to get your feelings hurt, because they may say things that they don't necessarily mean. They may not say thank you for everything they're doing. You may feel let down that they're not being more appreciative. But you see, part of the problem with depression is you get disconnected from your own emotions and your own thinking. In other words, we have to practice what we learned a couple of weeks ago. Separate the problem from the person. And sometimes it's the depression that's talking, not the person. And we have to remember, this isn't about my need. This is about this person's need. William Styron, the author of Sophie's Choice, went through a deep depression, and he wrote about it, a book called Darkness Visible. He tells about going to an award ceremony in Paris. And following the presentation of the award, he was to attend a luncheon with the French Academy. But instead, he wasn't able to think clearly. He had scheduled a luncheon with his publisher, something he could have easily canceled. But his emotions being detached, he said to the Academy, no, I can't make your luncheon. I'm going to lunch with my publisher. Well, they were tremendously offended. But in the moment, he wasn't even feeling what might happen. Only later did he realize and ask their apology. And that was the beginning of his healing, because he, for the first time, said, you must understand, I am not well. I'm sick. I am not right now who I really want to be. And of course, they did understand. But when we can focus on the other person's need and take our needs out of it, it helps, but it doesn't take care of everything. If we are trying to care for a family member we live with and are around a lot, we probably need to be in counseling as well. We need to be processing the hurt or the struggle or the feelings that we're going through, because we'll all run out of steam. Another way to be present: think, what can I do, not you do. What can I do? Rather than saying to somebody, well, if you would just do these things, think, no, okay, what is it I can do that would be helpful to the person? Last week, I talked about the importance of self-care. But when you're in a place of deep depression, the idea of cooking a meal for yourself seems impossible. Going to exercise seems more than you can accomplish. So maybe the most helpful thing to do to somebody is prepare a meal for them, to do their laundry, to not tell them to go exercise, but to say, hey, let's go to the gym together. Let's go take a walk, you and me. Parker Palmer talks about going through his depression and the people who gave unhelpful advice. But then he talked about some of the people who helped him the most. And he mentioned a man in his church, an elder, who asked permission to come to Parker's home every day about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, just to be present with him. And some days he would tell Parker to sit in a chair, and then he'd get down on his hands and knees and untie his shoes, take the shoes off, take the socks off, and rub his feet. I know that probably sounds a little odd, but listen to what Parker Palmer says about it. He found the only place in my body where I could still experience feeling and feel connected to the human race. He rarely spoke a word, and when he did, he never gave advice, but simply mirrored my condition. He would say, I can sense your struggle today, or it feels like you're stronger. I could not always respond, but his words were deeply helpful. They reassured me that I could still be seen by at least one other person. Life-giving knowledge in the midst of an experience that makes one feel annihilated and invisible. And then one last thing. Be persistently hopeful, not uncertain. Be persistently hopeful. When we've done the other things, when we have worked to build trust, that we're willing to understand what somebody's going through, when we're not just giving advice and telling them what to do, but we're willing to do things for another person, then that person might be open to hearing us say to them over and over and over again, you are going to get through this because we're going to get through it together. You're going to make it. You are going to get on the other side of this. I know you are. Now, if we've ever been around a depressed person, we might feel like that's about the last thing they want to hear. Why bother saying it? They will think it's almost a taunt. And yet, many people who write about their depression say that having people who loved them, who reassured them with the idea that they were going to make it, was significant. Again, William Styron, who wrote about his depression, said this toward the end of his book. It's of great importance that those who are suffering be told, be convinced, rather, that the illness will run its course and they will pull through. A tough job, this, calling chin up from the safety of the shore to a drowning person. It's tantamount to insult, but it's been shown over and over again that if the encouragement is dogged enough, and the support equally committed and passionate, the endangered one can nearly always be saved. It may require on the part of friends, lovers, family, admirers, an almost religious devotion to persuade the sufferer of life's worth, which is so often in conflict with the sense of their own worthlessness. But such devotion has prevented countless suicides. So let me say a final word to a particular group in our community. People who did love, people who did help someone going through depression and lost that person. I've heard from people in our church who say that experiencing the death of a loved one connected to depression leaves them every day with an ongoing battle of feeling like, I should have done more. I wish I would have done these things. And every day they have to fight that battle. Intellectually, they can know that that's not the case, but emotionally, it's a different story. And just like being in depression, information alone does not change the reality of the feelings. There has to be experience. I recommend two things. One is have a conversation with the person you lost. Have a conversation with them. They are now in a place to understand everything completely. They are in a place where that person knows what's in your heart. They know how much you love and how much you care. Let that person say to you, it is not your fault. It is not your fault. Hear them say thank you for what you did for me and the love you showed me. And the other thing is this. Look for ways God can turn your hurt to healing. Look for ways God can turn your hurt to healing. Last Sunday at the end of the 11 o'clock service, a woman in our church stood here and shared her story of a son who died who was in severe depression. He did not take his life, but it's believed that his death was deeply connected to the depression that he was in. And she talked about what happened to her and her family going through this. But one of the things that became very significant in the healing was she got involved in Outreach Inc., the ministry in downtown Indianapolis for homeless teenagers. She said, I turned my pain to other kids. And every time I'm helping a teenager, I know I'm helping my son. You see, the way we all find hope is to try to give hope. That's true of every one of us. We all experience greater light as we seek to offer light. I have yet to meet a person who says, I have all the hope I need. Everybody I know says, I could take a little more hope. You got some to spare? And the way that we find hope for ourselves is to seek to give hope. And that's the direction that this world of ours and this history that we share is going in. It's going into a day that will be complete light. The book of Revelation 22 pictures the day of God and says it's a day where there's no more darkness, there's no more tears, there's no more suffering. There will be no need for God's people to have a lamp or the light of the sun, for the Lord God will be their perpetual light. So we can live looking forward to that day by offering a glimpse of that hope now and know that God is with us always.